The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cardiac risk factors and non-invasive cardiac diagnosis, EKG, echo, and others is presented by Dr. Martin Burke.
I think if you looked at this particular lineup, it kind of goes back and forth between what Bob talked about and where I'm going right now. But I think it was good to look at the endpoint and then now move forward into understanding better how to evaluate these patients. And for the boards, I would tell you that the most important thing when you read the question to get to the answer is, number one, symptoms. And Bob brought that out a lot in the arrhythmia talk. And so that's very important that the patient has symptoms if you're going to do something interventionally or invasive. And interventional is pharmacologic as well. And then the second thing is really when you're looking at testing questions, it's about sensitivity and specificity. And I think what most clinicians who write the boards want to get to is that not every test has 100% sensitivity and 100% specificity. And so it's going to be up to the clinician to actually make those determinations. And that's a lot of what they try to test during the questioning. When you look at this particular section or lecture, I have about 15-20 minutes to describe the myriad of cardiac risk stratification testing. That's not a lot of time. So I'm going to go in mostly on the lingo, and I'm not going to go into great detail on the imaging modality specifics themselves, but really to give you a better understanding of the specificity and sensitivity in a case-based manner. I have no disclosure. So the most of these things that you're going to hear today during the board review are related to guidelines. And guidelines are not perfect. Actually, there's a lot of room for argument around the guidelines because the level of evidence is lacking, number one. And number two, most of the consensus class one indications are expert driven. And when there are randomized clinical trials, that increases the level of evidence either to an A or a B. But I think when you're looking at these particular this particular nomenclature, it's very important to have a baseline as you start to hear most of the lectures over the next few days. Bob talked a lot about where the lightning bolt is in that strip. I'm going to talk a little later this morning in the bottom half of that related to cardiomyopathies and congestive heart failure. For risk stratification, I'm going to talk mostly where the lightning bolt is. And this is the majority of the population. These are the people that are sitting there at high risk. And everything becomes a probabilistic curve. As you look at this, everybody has a risk of sudden death every single day. It's just that that risk is extremely low from a probabilistic likelihood. And as you decrease your ejection fraction, that likelihood goes up very high. And you can see that ejection fraction are on the lower bars there, and the mortality is quite high. It's the smaller number of patients per year that are at risk, but they have the highest per year probabilistic curve. And Bob brought that out in his lecture very nicely when he showed the risk of having three-vessel coronary disease and low ejection fraction. More importantly, when you have events, whether it's stroke events or any type of myocardial acute coronary syndrome, whether it's a demand ischemic event or a full-blown large artery thrombosis, you're going to see that ejection fraction also has a very high risk of within the week, within the month, risk of sudden cardiac death. And really what we're talking about when you see patients, when you're looking at the board examinations, is what are the risks of death? That's the most important thing a patient wants to know when they walk into your office. And then after that, it's risk modification to get to not having these events, because events cause death. And in the case of an acute myocardial infarction, the more extensive infarction causes lower ejection fraction. And you can see that this ejection fraction is low transiently. You can see that the ejection fraction at its worst after an acute myocardial infarction is less than 30%. But then after remodeling and the months go on with beta blocker and ACE inhibitor and spironolactone, as Bob brought out, your ejection fraction improves and your risk and your probabilistic curve in that time frame goes down. But how do we deal with these event rates, and how do we minimize them, and how do we predict who might have them is really the holy grail. And so that leads to this non-invasive cardiac imaging. And I'm going to briefly go into this from a nomenclature standpoint, because you just have to know for the boards, internal medicine, the general types and what you're going to be exposed to. And then you need to understand what are the best sensitive and specific tests by patient population. So these are all in your slide decks. The example of images, data typically provided by various non-invasive cardiac tests, and you can see the mainstay is electrocardiography. Frankly, within an internal medicine office, the electrocardiogram is the most sensitive test that you can perform on any patient. And that ranges from patients at risk of coronary disease and patients at risk for primary arrhythmic disease. It is, without a doubt, the most sensitive. It is the least specific. And so when you add on modalities to the electrocardiogram, you're trying to add specificity. So for instance, if you have a left bundle branch block patient, the specificity for coronary disease goes away, because the left bundle branch block pretty much negates your ability to tell whether or not they have any ischemia or infarction. Now maybe an infarction caused the left bundle branch block, but you can't necessarily tell that from the EKG. So then you get a stress test, whether it's pharmacologic and or exercise, and you put on an imaging modality to see whether or not there's a scar there as a cause for the left bundle branch block. Otherwise, you're not going to have the degree of specificity that you can get from that imaging test with the EKG alone. And so you move down the line and you have echocardiography as an imaging modality to increase specificity. You have nuclear imaging to increase specificity. And then you have CT and MRI. Now, MRI is increasing the specificity because it's giving you three-dimensional visualization and it's giving you physiologic information at the same time. So in a sense, you're looking at a new modality that's expanding in its indication and its ease of ordering and its availability in the community in order to do these tests. So when I was at the University of Chicago, it was a daunting situation to actually order a stress test, because you had five different types of stress test order. You could order just an exercise stress test without imaging. You could order imaging with pharmacologic stress. You could order imaging with pharmacologic stress and echo, or a stress echo, where you do exercise stress and get an echo. Or now you can do CT PET that gives you physiologic information about ischemic zones and or microvascular disease within the coronary tree. And then finally, you have cardiac MRI, which gives you the possibilities for not just three-dimensional imaging, ejection fraction, that's very appropriate, but you also get structural disease and scar data from gadolinium enhancement that you can obtain at the same time as you do the stress test with regadenoscene. And I'm going to show some data related to that. So just to give you an idea of the specificity of such tests, let's talk about a case, because it's always easier to remember this. 50-year-old Caucasian male with no prior history presents with palpitations and near syncope. He was found in the ER to have a Y-complex tachycardia with self-limiting. So the patient actually, before anything could be done to him, basically spontaneously converted to regular rhythm. pertinent history included that his father died at sudden death. Bob points out that it's very important to pick your parents, and in this case, that history is invaluable for this particular patient, as you see the age-matched diagnosis. No autopsy for that patient was done. He was just given the diagnosis that he had a heart attack, and that's very common. His exam was unremarkable. His EKG, is his 12-lead EKG and sinus rhythm, you can see here, generally doesn't look too bad, but in essence, there are subtle changes within the septum. He does not have R waves across V1 through V3. This is abnormal. He has a left axis deviation, and you could even say you cannot rule out myocardial infarction of the inferior wall with this patient. Now, when you look at this EKG, you might just say, hey, he's in sinus rhythm, thank God. He's not in the wide complex tachycardia. His blood pressure is good, and his exam is pretty well managed. This is the VT that he had. You can see this is at a slower paper speed just to give you the very exposed electrocardiographic changes here. So you see it's a very wide complex tachycardia. It's a right bundle branch block, meaning that it's coming from the left ventricle. And the axis is somewhat northwest. You can see that it's rightward and or negative in lead one, which is almost diagnostic of ventricular tachycardia. So we know this patient has ventricular tachycardia. We know he has an abnormal EKG, and now he's going to go through all of the normal electrocardiographic and imaging tests that a cardiologist could love. And there isn't a test that a cardiologist doesn't love. And I say that because I'm a cardiologist. So he had the EKG I showed you was abnormal. He had a chest x-ray, that was normal. He had an echocardiogram, that was normal. He had an angiography, that was normal. He had a stress test, that was normal. So for further diagnostic testing, we do a cardiac MRI. And this is without stress, this is without any type of pharmacologic vasodilatation. This is just a straight up morphologic MRI test. And now you can see that the specificity is coming through. And the only thing that was positive prior to this was the EKG. And that's one thing that you guys can see in your office right away. You don't have to have a cardiologist to get an EKG. So I bring that point out because you're the gatekeepers to actually deciding what is this patient's risk. And an EKG abnormality is probably the single most cause. Now, don't just fall down into the path that this is all coronary disease. You could have with that EKG, right? You could have said, this guy has definite coronary disease, he's got an anterior wall infarct in the septum, and he's got a problem with left axis deviation. That EKG is based on this positive late gadolinium enhancement in the septum, and it's due to an arrhythmic disease that's likely either an idiopathic genetic disease that his father had or sarcoidosis in this particular patient population. You can see here the electrophysiology test then ensued. The patient had inducible ventricular tachycardia. Actually, V1's on the bottom there. The surface on top, the intracardiac electrograms are on the bottom. You can see that the atrial electrogram is moving along in total dissociation to the ventricular electrogram. You're likely not to see this type of detail. This is more to give you an understanding that it is ventricular tachycardia. And then with pacing in a rapid sense, we're able to terminate this. This is an important piece to the pathophysiology of the ventricular arrhythmia. This patient was able to be pace terminated because it's a reentrant mechanism. And reentry is usually due to scar rather than focus. Focus can just be a single automatic center that's firing out ventricular arrhythmias. In this case, because we're able to pace terminate it, we're able to entrain it, we can actually terminate it with pacing. That's a sign that this is reentry as a mechanism. So the differential diagnosis, you could have a focal tachycardia, which is likely not true because of the EP study. He has diastolic dysfunction, likely due to genetic reasons. ARVC, you don't have to have the deposition of fat in the right ventricle. It can be actually across the entire spectrum of the ventricles. Sarcoidosis, inherited genetic arrhythmic disease, and then vasculitic disease, but that's usually more patchy and more epicardial. It's not in the segmented patchy area of the septum. The point of that is that the process of understanding this patient's pathophysiology was based first on his presentation, his symptoms, second on his abnormal EKG, and just having the normal run of tests, such as a stress test, an echocardiogram, a chest x-ray, an angiogram, did not yield anything. The specificity of those tests are limited. The sensitivity being negative did not mean that you stopped evaluating this patient and sent him on his own. He had to be further evaluated for his substrate. That ventricular tachycardia was ablated, but the patient still needed a defibrillator because he had structural heart disease, despite having preserved left ventricular function. Okay, so that was a good segue to genetic testing, because I think this is an area that's going to be burgeoning, and it's not quite ready for prime time, but you might start seeing some of this in the board tests. The subject should be informed and counseled in advance. And really, they're not going to talk to you about specifics of the genetic test and or the genetic abnormalities. What they're going to talk to you about on your test or try to elicit from you is that you understand the general moralistic, ethical process of this particular modality of risk stratification. And so the decision to make the test is a choice of the individual concerned. Written informed consent has to be signed and retained. There must be respect of the right to know and not to know for the subject. Molecular analysis should be performed in high quality medical laboratories. Results should be given in person to the individual and confidentially should be respected. These are the kinds of things you're going to see on an internal medicine examination, because that's what you are basically dealing with in your office. The goals of imaging cardiomyopathy. So we want to exclude an ischemic etiology at all times, because in the developed world, that's the most common cause for cardiomyopathy. Determine an underlying etiology, risk stratification, and prediction of need response to the device therapy. So when I presented that case, I went through all those things. The first thing we did was rule out that the patient had any ischemic etiology. And that might take one non-invasive test, or it might move on to an invasive test. Determine the underlying etiology. We had to do more testing, actually, to come to that conclusion. And even to this moment, we don't have a clear-cut understanding of why he has an infiltrative process in the septum of his heart. But this at least gives us some process to actually continue the monitoring phase and to understand better as time goes on, and to perform genetic tests that maybe today won't be valuable, but because he's in a data bank 10 years from now might be valuable, which might be valuable to the next generation of patient. And those are the reasons why I bring up the genetic testing as a process. I think as an etiologic process, you know, we're not going to always have the answer that day. I can tell you I had a patient who had long QT syndrome, a very nasty long QT syndrome as a child, had multiple VF episodes, survived them, got a defibrillator, was having shocks 20 times a year for VF. Despite best medical therapy, overdrive pacing the patient, it didn't work. I got a call about 12 years after he had his genetic test done. And the guy says, hey, I think I found out what kind of long QT syndrome this is. And as it turns out, he's one of the only surviving members of the class of patients with long QT8, which is called Timothy syndrome, after the child that was overly studied by his mother, and she forced them to continue to check this out. And it turns out that it's an enhanced calcium channel L-type channelopathy, and all I had to do was give the guy verapamil. He hasn't had VF since. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, but I'm telling you, the power of the genetics is not today, but it's later, and as the populations and the blood test data banking becomes bigger, eventually you'll get these answers. And so underlying etiology is extremely important, and it may not be known today, and that's why you have to go further to risk stratification. That's where the EP study came in. And then furthermore, prediction of need for a device. And so we predicted that because the patient had family history of sudden cardiac death, he presents with ventricular tachycardia. Even though that ventricular tachycardia is ablated, I know that that patient is still at risk for development of further cardiomyopathy, because I'm not sure about the etiology. I think it may be either sarcoidosis, ARVC, or some other genetic disorder that I haven't identified yet. So therefore, I'm going to further risk modify this patient's probability of sudden death with an ICD. Are there any questions about that? Because I covered in one single test a lot of different things surrounding specificity and sensitivity of a test, probability, etiology, and the whole process. And this is what we do every day. This is why Watson can't be you. You guys are the gatekeepers. You're the ones that are going to make these decisions on an individual basis. Population health is maybe important for genetic disorders and risk stratification and risk prediction, but they're not dealing with the single patient that you're facing in the office every single day. So what is myocardial perfusion imaging? You can see that it's overtaken the rest of testing in general over time. And these images are very variable. Some of them are scatter plots, and some of them are bougie-woogie type subjective visualizations. And with the advent of cardiac MRI, which matches anatomy very nicely to perfusion imaging, you're getting a lot more detail and a lot more ability to be specific to the condition rather than overly sensitive and subjective. The most important thing is to objectify risk prediction testing. Your subjective feeling, the patient's symptoms are always in play. You're trying to objectify and to basically adjudicate differences in those feelings. Special situations, I've already mentioned left bundle branch block, LVH with strain, digitalis effect. You're going to need to do imaging and not rely completely on the EKG for this type of risk stratification. And you can do imaging with transthoracic echocardiography or the various imaging modalities that I talked about with nuclear stress testing and or MRI, and in certain cases, CT PET. MRI gets more legs because it's being covered in a reimbursement model better than CT angio and CT physiology with PET scanning. Okay, just very quickly and to move on, the diabetic patient you can see is very daunting. And stress MRI can actually be much more beneficial and specific for these patients because you can actually get microvascular evaluations, which I think has a bigger impact on risk prediction and stratification. And furthermore, you can see stress CMR is coming into fruition and is as good or better than the current MRI situations that are used, specifically looking not at just exercise stress, which gives you a lot of physiologic impressions, such as blood pressure, but mostly within a comparison to a pharmacologic stress modality. And you can see that the prognostic value of regadenoside stress is very good and actually a lot better in terms of specificity. So when it's negative, it's truly negative compared to stress nuclear. And just in follow-up, I just want to tell you that when you're looking at females, stress testing is extremely low specificity. And so you have to be very careful in patients when you're doing these tests in an asymptomatic population and not use them as a de facto critical decision maker. I've seen this a lot where patients have a negative stress echo and then they're almost obliterated from the face of a clinician's eye that they have coronary artery disease, and that's wrong. You cannot say that. This is what is going to be tested. It's going to be tested whether or not this is a specific and or a sensitive test. And just because it's negative does not really mean that it could be falsely negative. And so you have to take this into account when you're looking at any of the testing that you're doing in risk prediction. And you can see that the best predictive accuracy that you can see with any of these tests, moving down, the only one that's not on here is CMR, is about 88%. Stress echo is good when you have you avoid the nuclear risks, and that's good. The radiation risks are obliterated. The sensitivity and the specificity are about the same. They can be a little subjective, and it's not necessarily three-dimensional, which is why CMR will likely take it over. And the false positives are seen in patients with hypertensive responses and in patients with cardiomyopathies. If you have a baseline cardiomyopathy, it makes a stress echo read a lot more difficult. I can tell you that in all the modalities, there's no class one. It's all 2A, 2B, and 3. There's not a lot of consensus on these in a class one indication. So they're ripe for testing. they're ripe for testing. Class one and class three are in, and in the middle, you really have to have a good understanding of what you're going to do with these patients. And then perioperative cardiac testing, you can see that the risk is more to do the test than it is to not do the test. So most of the steps are to avoid stress testing perioperatively. The only group that you would consider doing perioperative stress testing are those patients that cannot get 4 METs of exercise for one reason or another. And that's not leading up to their injury, that they may be having a knee surgery or something, it's all before that. Those are rare cases, and still I would use a lot of your clinical judgment in doing a stress test in these patients, because the worst thing you can do is have a positive stress test that leads you down the primrose path of actually doing invasive action, and then leading to the patient having coronary artery disease, and then the clinical decision tree that's very difficult. Should you put a stent in that patient perioperatively? The answer is likely no, unless they have left main disease that they can't go for revascularization. Furthermore, if they have aortic stenosis and or high degree AV block, those are monitors to actually take some invasive action preoperatively, but then get them to surgery because that's their main complaint. So if they don't have any type of serious METS problem, you should probably avoid doing stress testing prior to any surgery. And then this is just some mild caveats and logical things related to percutaneous coronary intervention perioperatively. It should be for patients with left main disease who can't get bypassed due to undue risk, and patients with unstable coronary artery disease who are candidates for emergent or urgent. They already have an ACS going on, they have to get it. And then the CARP trial demonstrated that you showed no difference in perioperative and long-term cardiac outcomes with or without preoperative CABG or PCI in patients with CAD. You just have to manage them and monitor them closely for the first week, first 48 hours, and usually the MIs happen 40 hours after surgery. Exception is left main disease, ejection fraction less than 20% with severe dilated cardiomyopathy and or heart failure, and then severe AS. And those are obvious. Those are things that you know. But those are the three things you'll be testing on. And they'll probably be all three there, and then you'll have to exclude one or say all the above. So I'll stop there, and these are the references around for us. Thank you.